Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and glad you could join us here at Africa Link this Wednesday, the 25th of October, 2017. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Jane Ayeka Kumet. Remember, we are live on Facebook as well, so do let us know where you're listening from and leave us your comment or two.
And in today's edition, Kenya's opposition leader Raila Odinga transforms the NASA coalition into a resistance movement and calls on his supporters to boycott Thursday's presidential election.
From today, we are transforming the NASA coalition into a resistance movement.
And Nigeria's former president Goodluck Jonathan is to be summoned to court to testify in a corruption trial.
Money meant to buy equipment and fight Boko Haram to the tune of $2 billion was diverted for campaigns of the party.
Those stories and a lot more coming up shortly, but first let's see what has been happening around the world.
My name is Jane Nyinge with DW News. We start off in Kenya, where the chairman of the Electoral Commission, Wafula Chebukati, has said the repeat presidential poll will go ahead tomorrow as planned. This is despite the boycott of the main opposition leader Raila Odinga and numerous concerns over its credibility.
All polling stations will open tomorrow at 6 a.m. and would like to urge you to wake up early in the morning, present yourselves at your respective polling stations and vote for your preferred presidential candidate. Thereafter, please go back home and wait for announcement of results. So the commission is monitoring all the activities and we shall be able to inform the country as we go along.
Meanwhile, opposition leader Raila Odinga has urged his supporters to stay at home tomorrow as voting process goes ahead. Now to South Sudan, where President Salva Kiir has appealed for more engagement with the U.S. to bring lasting peace to the country. Kiir made the announcement during a meeting with the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, who is in the country for a one-day visit. Haley is on a three-nation tour of Africa to see the involvement of the U.S. and the United Nations in Ethiopia, South Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Moving on, Israeli authorities have approved a major expansion of a Jewish settler in the heart of a Palestinian neighborhood of East Jerusalem. The expansion would create the largest Israeli settlement inside Palestinian neighborhood. Wassel Abu Yosef, a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, condemned the move.
We have to apply all methods, including the popular resistance on the ground, against the settlement and to boycott this Israel occupation, which does not commit to any of the international laws.
You are listening to DW, Germany's international broadcaster. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged the international community to act in solidarity to help the Central African Republic deal with the chaos and violence. Guterres, who will be in the country for a four-day visit, today paid tribute to the UN peacekeepers who died while serving the UN mission in the country.
We are here to serve the people, to sacrifice ourselves for the people we care for. And your example is something that I will always remember. Your sacrifice is something that the UN will always honor.
And finally, in Turkey, the trial of 11 human rights defenders detained on terrorism charges began today. The Turkish forces under the control of President Tayyip Erdogan arrested lawyers and human rights defenders after attending a workshop on digital security. The case has sparked worldwide concerns over Turkey's justice system, triggering tension with Europe. For more news and information, visit dw.com or download the DW app. My name is Jen Nyingi.
You're listening to Africa Link with me, Crispin Mwakideo.
And me, Jane Ayeko Kumet.
Now, from coalition to resistance movement, Kenya's opposition leader Raila Odinga has told his supporters that they were transforming the NASA coalition into a resistance movement. The statement comes just hours before polls open in Kenya's controversial repeat presidential election. President Uhuru Kenyatta has insisted on the election taking place as planned, and this was confirmed by the chairman of the Electoral Commission, Wafula Chebukati, on Wednesday. James Chimanyula is in Nairobi and summarized to me what Odinga has been saying.
In summary, what The seasonal opposition leader Raila Odinga has just told a huge crowd in central Nairobi is that they should not participate in tomorrow's, that is Thursday, repeat presidential election, because, as he put it, that is a sham election, and that people should be prepared to rally behind him because he's now transformed the National Super Alliance political party that they formed in a coalition, commonly known as NASA, has been transformed into a revolutionary movement. Let's listen to Raila Odinga speaking to the crowd, starting with the voting that takes place Thursday.
From today, we are transforming the NASA coalition into a resistance movement.
Kenya's opposition leader, Raila Odinga. Now, James, there must be some kind of reactions after he say that he will transform the NASA coalition into a resistance movement. This must have raised some eyebrows.
Shortly after Odinga's talking about revolution, the big slum of Kibera, which is one of Raila Odinga's slums, I mean his strongholds rather, the supporters of Odinga have barricaded all roads leading to Kibera, and not even the police that have been using tear gas and water cannons can enter there. And they have said it's a no-go zone area. In other words, they are blocking the roads, lighting bonfires, and putting on the road all sorts of assortment to prevent election officials from delivering ballot papers. And the same thing has happened elsewhere.
DW correspondent James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
And to follow up on the developments in Kenya, I've been speaking to Pat Tucker, editorial director of Middle East and Africa at the Economist Intelligence Unit, and he started by telling me what we make out of this political settlement. Take a listen.
It's getting harder to see how Kenya can return to normality or business as usual for the remainder of this year and even into next year.
Assuming that the election actually does go ahead as planned, how do you see the electoral process playing out and what is likely to happen next?
Kenyatta is almost certain to win the second round almost uncontested, which in turn will probably trigger further brinkmanship in the form of another legal petition by the opposition. It basically takes away the credibility of the whole presidency. Election.
So what is the way out of this political stalemate?
There's a couple of scenarios. Dialogue between the two key leading parties to come to some kind of a political move away from this political stalemate for in the interest of the country, which is highly unlikely to take place. Third is international intervention.
We've been hearing reports in which the judges say the polling officers are illegal. Should the election go ahead tomorrow and whoever the winner turns out to be, will this be a credible election and will the president actually be acknowledged by the Kenyans as well as the leading opposition party?
No, the leading oppositions will never accept Kenyatta as a credible elected leader. I mean, the whole thing is highly dubious now. I think the best solution forward would be to delay the rerun election into early next year, allow the Supreme Court and IEB to reorganize and create a better environment, a more transparent environment for the re-election to take place.
After the 2007 post-election violence and the constant attacks from Al-Shabaab, apart from these, Kenya has exhibited stability and economic progress. Could this election set back this pace?
Oh, yes, it already has. The election impasse is now becoming a standout worry for investors. This comes on top of the unsustainable state spending and a major drought from last year that has gone into this year, the election period. Risk of this is also added to the political risk as well. Political clashes has not only threatened the economy, it's actually derailed, it's taken Kenya's economic drive off the rail as well.
What implications does this stalemate have in the region?
It doesn't mean this is the end of Kenya. What it does mean is this is going to delay economic development and progress that's been taking place in the country for the last 4 years.
Pat Tucker, Editorial Director of Middle East and Africa at the Economist Intelligence Unit.
Now, Ayeko, in another development on Kenya, the Chief Justice David Maraga was forced on Wednesday to postpone a last-minute hearing on whether or not to delay a presidential election. Now, we asked our Facebook users, what do they make of this news? And yes. Teddy says, that is good progress for democracy in Africa.
That's good progress in Africa, says Teddy. But from Lamine Fafana, he says, is actually questioning what's happening in the politics in Kenya. Kenya's democracy is very good.
I think a lot of people are asking the same questions. What is exactly happening in Kenya? Charles Ongole John says there is a sinister hand of Jubilee. That's the ruling party, Jubilee. And those who don't wish Kenya democratic governance in this last minute legal gaffe.
A mixture of comments there. Those who are for and those who are against Jubilee. Zizida Zaba says, if the delay helps the credibility of the election, then it's acceptable. The downside, however, is how much money will be lost due to this delay or the negative consequences of the delay on the Kenyan economy.
Right,
and that's just something that we had the analyst also talk about.
Exactly. Now let's leave Kenya aside and move to Nigeria, where a judge on Wednesday ordered Nigeria's former president, Goodluck Jonathan, to appear at the corruption trial of his party's former spokesman. The summons is a surprise development and will be keenly watched, as Jonathan has been cited in several corruption cases, but is not thought to have been formally questioned. DW correspondent in Abuja, Ben Shemang, has been explaining to me the background to the corruption trial.
For us to understand this issue, we also have to get the background to this case. What happened was that during the days of Jonathan as president, he had a national security advisor called Colonel Sambo Dasuki, and money was meant to buy equipment and fight Boko Haram to the tune of $2 billion. But again, the money was diverted for campaigns of the party. And so the spokesman of the party, Metu, Olisa Metu, is being accused. And it is Metu who is now calling on former President Jonathan to come and testify in the court in this matter.
You say that the money that was meant to fight Boko Haram was diverted to the campaigns. So presumably this is something that the party, the PDP party back then, must have been aware of. Is that what you're saying?
Well, exactly. The ruling party now, the All Progressives Congress, is insisting that since the money was meant to fight insurgency or terrorism in Nigeria, that they've discovered that the money was actually diverted for campaigns to ensure the ruling party then retained its power, but it was defeated.
What do the supporters of the PDP make of all this in Nigeria?
Well, the supporters of PDP, as expected, believe that it's just prosecution against them. They feel that because they are out of power, the ruling party now wants to establish some firm grounds by discrediting the old party then. So they feel really that it's a persecution. But again, the government is quick at replying that whoever committed an offense, people must learn to obey the law, equality before the law, and not some people feeling they are on top of the law.
Ben Shemang in Abuja.
Yes, Crispin. This is also one topic that we asked our followers to follow on, to comment, and indeed, they've been commenting. I start with one coming in from Patrick. He says, good news for Nigeria on the fight against corruption. This shows the strength of the judiciary. But what about the loads of other corrupt government officials in this present administration who are walking free?
That's a good question. Namdi also comments, fight against corruption in Nigeria is a scam.
David, also from Nigeria, says, party witch hunt. That's the only thing the Nigeria chief executive officer of corruption himself is busy doing. Yes, that's an interesting one. Also coming in from Nigeria, Isaac is writing from Ria, Liberia, says, I doubt Goodluck will be held accountable for those corruption allegations and recently exposed deals from the oil company Shell.
And Chidi says, from Anambra, says President Buhari is fooling himself by asking the former president to appear at a corruption trial where Buhari himself is the father of corruption in Nigeria.
Keep those comments coming and we'll read them when we can. Yo still listening to Africa Link with me, Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Thanks for joining us live on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
Coming up in this half of Africa Link, helping farmers cope with climate change with SMS in Senegal.
The weather is our bad luck. When cultivating, if you don't have the right information, then really you are farming blind.
And also coming up, fighting club foot disease in Tanzania.
But first, let's talk about child marriage. Now, 6 out of 10 countries with the highest prevalence of child marriage in the world are in West and Central Africa. For the first time, African political leaders, activists and local chiefs from 27 countries gathered to commit to ending child marriage in the region. According to the World Bank, child brides are costing the region up to $60 billion annually. How? Emmanuel Landes reports.
Almost 15 million girls are affected by child marriage worldwide each year. In Africa, the worst offenders are West African countries, with the highest rates recorded in Niger, followed by the Central African Republic, Chad and Mali. This is according to World Bank figures. Speaking on a panel, Marie-Christine Bokoum, the African Union Special Rapporteur on Ending Child Marriages, said the biggest fallout of child marriage is girls leaving school.
One of the first consequences of marrying children is that they're taken out of school, with all the social and economic consequences of this lack of schooling, because it ends up reinforcing their chances of staying in permanent poverty. In their new lives, child brides face domestic abuse as they aren't in a position to run a household.
In their new lives, child brides face domestic abuse as they aren't in a position to run a household.
Often, the spouses, the men to whom they're married off to, and who are much older than them, much more mature, and who have life experience, find it hard to accept this ignorance, and it often ends in domestic violence.
Eric Hazard, Regional Campaign and Policy Director at Save the Children, says there are a lot of double standards at play because in countries that have ratified the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, child marriage continues.
Children have some rights, and they have the right to get access to education, they have the right to get access to health. So when children get married, definitely you broke all his right. He does not get access to his right anymore. Many countries have been signing the Child Rights Convention, which recognizes that the children until the age of 18 have some right, and this right need to be respected.
If child marriage was stopped, the fertility rate would drop by 10%, impacting not only population growth but regional economy, according to Quentin Wadon, lead economist at the World Bank, speaking at the Ending Child Marriage Conference in Dakar.
We estimate that by 2030, it would be valued at almost $60 billion in purchasing power parity terms. So that's very large. That means that the populations would be better off by that amount, simply because there would be, for the same amount that is produced, fewer people to feed, clothe, and so on. And so the standards of living would increase by that amount.
On average, girls who marry early in West and Central Africa have more children. But less people means a better standard of living, says The Economist.
More children over the lifetime of the woman, and so population growth would be reduced substantially if child marriage were ended. And that's where the biggest economic benefit lies. Less people, very simply.
And the economic cost of child brides doesn't stop there. In further research, the World Bank found the children of child brides are more likely to die before age 5 or suffer from stunting due to malnutrition, said Wadon. Earlier in October, 15 ECOWAS member states adopted a regional child protection framework to prevent, protect and support girls at risk of child marriage. The challenge now is moving from vision to action.
Emmanuel Lande with that report on child marriage.
Right, Ayeko. And on our Facebook page, we do have comments here and people listening in. Samuel Amaechi says on the Nigerian story that APC is clueless. Calling out Jonathan is like calling out Buhari because a lot of corruption has been committed in his administration. I represent Biafra. I mean, that's one of the comments. Rashid Naz says, I'm listening in from Pakistan on your program. So thank you for joining us also on Facebook Live.
And keep those comments coming.
On the spot.
Now, not being able to walk well hampers people's ability to go to school or to work and impacts on their whole life. That's what many children who are born with clubfoot, one of the most common birth defects worldwide, face. Clubfoot can be treated, but while in rich countries with good health systems, the problem is corrected when the kids are young. That's often not possible for children in rural Africa, like in Tanzania. This report by Julia Gross is now presented by Nick Martin.
So the foot was in an equinous position, facing downwards, and we've already isolated and cut the Achilles tendon. Here we've got the nervus tibialis, that's the nerve leading to the sole. We've opened the upper ankle joint from the back, and now it's possible to move the foot out of this downward-looking position pretty well.
Und es lässt sich der Fuß schon deutlich aus der Spitzfußstellung korrigieren.
Anne-Marie Schrammel, an orthopedic surgeon from Nuremberg in Germany, is standing in a brightly lit operating theatre in the Nkoranga Hospital in Uzariva on the slopes of Mount Meru in northern Tanzania. The German doctor is performing surgery on 13-year-old Hassan Salim Meyer. The boy has had problems walking all of his life because of clubfoot. Schrammel and her team have been coming to this hospital regularly for almost 20 years to perform orthopaedic surgeries.
This is going to look a bit brutal.
Approximately 1 in 1,000 babies is born with clubfoot. It's one of the most common birth defects worldwide. One foot, or as in about half of all cases, both feet are pointing downwards and inwards. And patients like Hassan can only walk on the edge or even on the top of the affected foot. They can't wear normal shoes and they can't walk long distances. In Europe and the US, children usually begin treatment right after they are born. By the time they are 3 or 4 years old, their feet are corrected and they can walk normally. But in poor countries like Tanzania, clubfoot often stays untreated, with grave consequences, as Sarah Raymond explains.
A lot of the times the children who are coming into us have never had any kind of education before because they can't walk to school, can't walk 7 or 10 kilometres to go to school. Or even if the school is close by, the parents don't want them to be out and seen in the community.
Raymond is the director and founder of the Plaster House in Arusha, a place where children are taken care of before and after orthopaedic surgeries. If medical problems go untreated, these kids often face a life in poverty because it's hard for them to find a job and most lack education. On top of that, children with clubfoot face discrimination.
The way people perceive disability almost changes tribe by tribe by tribe. So there are still some tribes here, if a child is born with a disability, that the child will be killed.
And even if people know they can get treatment, many are unable to afford it.
And that report was written by Julia Gross. And back on our Facebook page, we have comments on the Kenyan elections, which are due tomorrow. Samuel Yeboah from Ghana says, "I wish Kenyans a peaceful presidential rerun election." And Ahmed Salisu Ahmed also says, "Dear Kenyans, keep calm and avoid violence."
Living Planet Africa.
In Senegal, farmers have long used traditional techniques to read the weather and predict rainfall, a vital element for a country whose agriculture is rain-fed. But now, because of climate change, these century-old techniques no longer work. Yields are suffering because of extreme weather patterns, putting the livelihoods of millions of rural households in danger. But a new technique has been developed, sending science-based climate information by text messages to farmers across the country. Emmanuel Andy has more from Sikilo village in Senegal.
On the outskirts of Sikilo, some 250 kilometres southeast of the capital Dakar, rests a small village made up of concrete huts grouped together per family. Just a few hundred people live here. Aliou Njabi, the village chief, inspects his fields. He cultivates groundnuts and small seeded grasses or millet. Aliou, like many farmers across Senegal, is waiting for the monsoon season to start. The weather here can be a real curse, he says.
L'information météo, c'est de malchance.
The weather is our bad luck. When cultivating, if you don't have the right information, then really you are farming blind. The most important factor for farmers is to have climate information.
L'information changement climatique.
Senegal's predominantly rain-fed agriculture is highly vulnerable to climate change as production depends largely on the amount of rainfall. Traditionally, Senegalese farmers relied on indicators from their environment to predict the weather. This knowledge was passed down from one generation to the next. For 33-year-old farmer Maria Makeda, when the towering baobab tree at the entrance of her village sprouted leaves, that meant the rain would come, but not anymore.
It's changed a lot. Before we had a lot of rain, there were lots of trees. Now it's like this. There's little water, and so the farmers are forced to work with less water. It doesn't rain as much now.
Rainfall is rarer and more precious than ever, but there is hope. Sikilo's farmers now have modern technology at their fingertips to stand in for the natural signs that have been thrown off kilter by the changing climate. They rely on climate information sent via text message from the National Agency of Civil Aviation and Meteorology, known as ANACIM, based in Dakar. In 2010, Sikilo became the first so-called climate smart village in Senegal.
98%, c'est correct.
Up to 98%, it is spot on. The messages can arrive at any time except in the dry season. The messages don't come as usual, but they go along the lines of forecast. There will be rain in the vicinity of Kafrine in 2 hours. That's how we get the message.
To reach as many people as possible, ANACIM has partnered with a community radio network to broadcast weather information in French as well as local languages. Tala Diang is the president of the community radio network for Senegal that groups 96 local radio stations.
ANACIM taught our presenters how to translate the weather bulletin into local languages. Today, our radio network even gathers the climate data because ANACIM gave us rain gauges, taught the presenters how to read them, which we send back to them. Not only do we broadcast, but we gather climate information.
Today, next to seeds and fertilizer, simple mobile phones have become an important tool in building climate resilience. Following SMS weather forecasts instead of environmental indicators meant last year, Mariama's test plot yielded 1.5 tons more groundnuts than her other plot.
Emmanuel Lande with that report all the way from Sikilo village in Senegal.
Right, and now let's go to Tanzania. There, the press freedom is again under threat after the government closed another newspaper, bringing to 5 the number of publications which have recently been shuttered. 4 newspapers have already been forcibly closed in Tanzania, while 2 radio stations were shuttered but are now back on the air. And all this is happening after President John Pombe Magufuli took office. We asked the question on Facebook, does Africa have another dictator in the East African nation?
Yes, indeed. Some people have been commenting. Espoa says, when a government doesn't want to work for the population, it starts closing down the media.
And David from Nigeria says, that's a big dictator, just like a Nigerian ruler, Mr. Muhammad Buhari of Nigeria. That's too bad in these days. Africa is in a big mess.
Interesting comments coming in there. Petrida Paul says, I'm a Tanzanian, and yes, he is slowly transforming into a dictator as he shuts down any media house that talks ill or questions his decisions in public, and he does not value girls or women's rights at all.
And of course, we had this story not so long ago when he also hinted that homosexuality is unacceptable in Tanzania. So it's not only about the girls or women's rights, but there are other accusations or allegations that he also doesn't value the rights of homosexuals. And of course, this is a very controversial topic in Africa.
Yes. Anyway, quick one coming in from Ihimburu from Cameroon says Africa is undergoing a change and a long way. And in along the way, many things can happen. Almost true leadership will soon emerge in Africa when the current foundation has been completely laid.
And Isaac Godwin says John Magufuli is becoming more like a tyrant, although his commitment to our development is inspiring. But there is the other dark side of him that hate many things.
Interesting comments there. Unfortunately, that's all we had time for. From me, Jen Ayeko Kumet.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Bye.